Small Town Podcast is made possible by generous support from the Georgia Municipal Association. GMA supports Georgia cities. Small Town Podcast is supported by the Southern Mercantile. Visit southernmercantile.com for a blog about small town living and an online store with a selection of carefully curated goods. The Southern Mercantile. Simple living, Southern charm.
Hi, I'm Kay Pippen, and I'm the mayor of the city of Jackson, Georgia. And I just want to encourage all of our members of Congress and the president to do all they can to protect the current funding for the Community Development Block Grants, the CDBG funds that come down to local governments. Coming from a small city, I can tell you that it is the lifeline to help us to make major improvements in our infrastructure. My city had never been the recipient of federal funds. We applied for them in 16. We got a $500,000 grant. The city of Jackson has put about $350,000 with that money. And by spending that near $1 million, we have repaired the sewer lines. We had already been working on the water lines in what was really the worst infrastructure area of our entire city. So when the residents in that area, which is a very old section of our community, but when those residents for years have suffered with pipes that weren't working, I am ashamed to admit that I actually saw open sewage in a couple of places before this project started. We were the recipient, we got busy on the project, and as of about a week ago, we wrapped it up completely. And now about 60 homes in a neighborhood that has a good deal of poverty in it now have the finest water and sewer lines in our entire city. And this would not have happened but for being a recipient of the Community Development Block Grant. So everybody connected with federal policy, federal decision making, help your small communities, all communities actually, by continuing to fund and to even increase the funding for the Community Development Block Grants.
Hey, small towners, it's Mayor Matt Seal of the great city of Ocilla, Georgia, and this is a workshop episode of Small Town Podcast. Now, usually I start these episodes myself, but I couldn't have done it better than Mayor Kay Pippen from the small town of Jackson, Georgia. I recently had the opportunity to talk to several local government officials at the annual convention of the Georgia Municipal Association this summer. While there were many classes and panel discussions on a variety of topics that we all deal with in our cities, there's one topic that seems to be getting more and more important, and in some cities, things are getting more and more desperate. I'm talking about infrastructure. That's roads, bridges, water and sewer, energy, communications, transportation and transportation hubs. It's a big category, and it's difficult to cover all of it well in one podcast episode. You'll be hearing from more local officials throughout this episode and hearing about the things that they are focused on. One thing that we will focus on is the structure of how infrastructure maintenance and building projects are funded. We hear a lot of talk at the federal level about infrastructure packages and bills going through Congress. Before I was the mayor of Ocilla, I did not realize how dependent we are at the local level on funds from the federal level that sometimes pass through the state level before it makes it to cities of all sizes. Now, while I'm in Georgia, and that is the focus of our information for this episode, this is an issue that cities across America are dealing with. On this episode, we're going to talk to a variety of guests to try to cover all the angles.
Hi, I'm Brittany Kohler. I work with the National League of Cities, working on transportation and infrastructure issues across the country.
Hi, I'm Chad Griffin, Principal, CEO, and Founder of Stillwaters Engineering.
Hello, I'm Gary Black. I'm Commissioner of Agriculture for the state of Georgia.
Hi, this is Jay Roberts. I'm Director of Planning for the Georgia Department of Transportation.
But before we talk to any of them, I wanted to start with the person that I began this conversation with months ago. Most of my education as a local elected official has come by way of the Georgia Municipal Association, and this issue was no different.
Hi, I'm Becky Taylor. I'm the Director of Research and Federal Relations for GMA.
So we're talking today about infrastructure, and I've actually, just in talking to you, have learned a lot about how much the federal government has to do with my
very local infrastructure in Osceola, Georgia, and of course all cities in Georgia and other states too. Just describe that for a little bit. We've had a lot of discussions. You put out a lot of information about some of the things that are taking place, the conversations about an infrastructure overhaul. Obviously, that's a big topic nationwide. Mm-hmm. What is the impact? And even talk about how some of that funding works, because, you know, like I've described to you, as a new mayor, I had no idea how much federal funding just passed through the state. I just assumed it came from the state. So just speak to that for a little bit.
Right. And I thought that was interesting that you mentioned DCA's CDBG.
Yeah, Community Development Block Grant.
They administer that program, but the funding actually comes from Housing and Urban Development. Mm-hmm. It all comes from the federal government. But that is probably the most widely used grant program for small cities in Georgia. The DCA administered what they call a small city CBG program. That and things like USDA Rural Development Funds. USDA has tons of different programs for all kinds of different types of infrastructure needs and technical assistance. And small cities access that. All that comes from the federal government. So when you hear Congress talking about reauthorizing the Farm Bill, the authorization for the programs that we use in small cities in Georgia comes through the Farm Bill. The appropriations process, same thing when you hear about funding for domestic programs, for discretionary programs, that's all important to our cities, making sure that programs like CDBG continue to get funded.
That's HUD passing through to the Department of Community Affairs in Georgia. And do you have any figures on how much that might be?
About $36 million comes to DCA from HUD for the CDBG program.
So that's federal money, and that's just to Georgia. Mm-hmm. Imagine that number is similar, maybe greater in other states throughout the nation. Okay, so $36 million coming through. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, you're saying that's the small cities program, so that is separate from the annual community development block grant applications. The city of Osceola just got awarded one last year. We're going to do about a $1.3 million infrastructure project. And I can attest for sure, there's no way we would be able to do that without the $750,000 grant that came through. Now, obviously, we're having to put up money of our own. But that's just small cities. So what? Mm-hmm. Explain the CDBG aspect of that, too.
Well, HUD funds the CDBG program, and for example, like in Georgia, a portion of the CDBG allocation goes directly to, basically, it's what we call the hub cities in Georgia. So Atlanta, Athens, Augusta, Columbus, they all get...
Osceola's not a hub city in Georgia.
Right. Those are entitlement communities, so they get a set amount of funds. And all of the distribution, there's a formula that HUD uses to distribute CDBG funds to different states that takes into account a lot of demographic characteristics, income, and right. poverty, and things like that. So some of the, around the same amount, about $36 million, we'll say, goes to the entitlement program. For CBGs and CBG for small cities, the one that DCA administers gets about $36 million.
All right, so those are funds that come from HUD at the federal level through our Department of Community Affairs, but you also mentioned USDA. That's real big. We know about them. There's an office about 30 minutes away from Osceola. So talk about how some of that works, because I think that when I became the mayor, I'd heard of that. I've heard of USDA, of course, and some of the grants and programs there. But just the size of that and the different kinds of things it does, especially for rural communities and small towns, which we end up focusing on this podcast. So speak to that a little bit, some of the USDA programs and how they pass through.
Okay. Well, USDA rural development is really critical for small cities in Georgia, and they do have a whole lot of different types of programs. One of the most popular is the Community Facilities Program, and it's very versatile, it's very flexible. You can use that for anything. It's one of the only sources that I know of that you can use to get funds for a city hall improvements or a new city hall. But they also do all kinds of water and sewer. They do everything. They have utility service. They provide broadband infrastructure funding and technical assistance. A lot of they have what are called grant and loan programs, but most of the funds now, it's really hard to find any grant funds. You may get some grant money, but you also have to have a loan with that. But the loans are very low interest. They, a lot of times, will be the last piece of the puzzle for cities to be able to complete a project. And USDA, you know, their focus is working with rural communities, so they're very good about sitting down and, you know, kind of helping cities put together partnerships between different agencies to make things happen. They're very focused on economic development. They understand the unique needs in rural areas of the state. So that's a really important agency for us, and we're very, very fortunate, too, to have a secretary who was a former Georgia governor.
That's right.
So that really helped us a lot.
Now, let me ask this, and this may be an ignorant question. So the one piece of legislation you've mentioned, because there's so many conversations that haven't materialized into a bill necessarily yet, but you mentioned the Farm Bill. I would think that that would have some impact on the Department of Agriculture and some of the mm-hmm. funding there. So speak to that a little bit. What's at play? Because I know from my limited experience so far, USDA and those rural development programs are definitely a go-to. We've applied for some of the community mm-hmm. facilities grants you've already mentioned. There seem to be some complications, and there's always, oh yes, you've been approved for this, now we just have to wait for funding. Seems to be a very common response. And that might be because of continuing resolutions. It might be because things are in play because of an upcoming farm mm-hmm. bill. So just educate me and obviously our audience too on some of those, I guess, moving parts and some of the impact of the Farm Bill on USDA and those programs.
Well, if you have an application that's been funded, then you should be fine. The WERDA is, as I understand it, is the legislation that authorizes all these programs and includes the focus areas for all these programs that are in there. And then you still are subject to appropriations for each program. But if you've been approved for a grant, then the grant funds are there.
So there's a separate appropriation bill. So that's where the money's at. That's mm-hmm. what the appropriation means. So you may be approved for it, but then there has to be a separate passage of appropriation
right.
to make sure then thing
mm-hmm.
comes to you.
The programs are authorized through this big umbrella legislation, and then funding has to be appropriated.
I'm glad you're dealing with this because this sounds really complicated to me. Now, to go back to the Farm Bill and what might be in play, is there a potential impact if the Farm Bill passes as is, or maybe gets altered or doesn't pass at all, or gets held off for another year? How would that impact some of those programs in USDA?
They'll probably, and it's not unusual for Congress to kind of do an extension to things.
Sure.
So if it's not approved by the end of the year, then they'll probably do like a one-year extension and keep talking about it.
Very similar to the continuing resolutions we've
right.
seen for several years now.
I'm Kenneth Ursher, the mayor of City of Thompson, population about 5,800 people, just 30 miles west of Augusta, Georgia. We will be in the process of applying for a loan. We've got a 50-year-old aging sewer system. We got a 55-year-old aging water plant. Those type things we need money for. You know, good stewards, good managers, but still you don't generate enough revenue from year to year to maintain those facilities. And so right now our engineers are putting together a loan application for us. And we also, and part of the reason is we're looking for some forgiveness toward the end of that loan, and that is available to us through the federal loan program. It's some forgiveness, 25%. Without that, we probably would not apply for these funds.
Describe the impact if there was a cut, or even maybe some of these programs went away. What would that mean to your community and its infrastructure?
My aging system will continue to age, but with Band-Aid repairs. And we're going to wake up one morning and be out of compliance with EPD. And so it's critical that not only in my city, but all these small cities have support from the federal government. Funds are needed, just to survive.
Hello, my name is Kenneth Smith. I'm the mayor of Kingsland, Georgia. I've been the mayor for 16 years, and I served 16 years on the city council in the city of Kingsland, Georgia.
And what's the population of Kingsland, Georgia?
Population is in excess of 18,000, and it fluctuates because of our military presence in the community.
So talk about the importance of federal fund programs, whether it's the CDBG or the LMIG, if you've got T grants that you've utilized, the importance of those on maintaining and improving your infrastructure in Kingsland.
All of those programs are really essential, especially to small communities in southeast, southwest Georgia. They have served tremendously in helping us to help with our infrastructure, the aging infrastructure of some of the highways, some of the inner streets that we have that's being repaved. So it has helped us immensely in maintaining a better quality community.
Sharon Subedan, city manager in Albany, Georgia.
And what's the population of Albany, Georgia? It's not a small town.
Nope. Relative to others in Georgia, we have a population of 74,000.
What is the impact for the city of the federal funds that come down through the state, through LMIG, through CDBG, maybe some other programs that you've utilized? How do you use those in Albany?
So in Albany, we have a large population that live at or below the poverty line, and we receive significant HUD funding for affordable housing. We are an entitlement community, which means that we get our allocation from HUD directly, so it does not flow through the state. But because of the HUD dollars that we receive, we're able to facilitate emergency housing for homeless persons. We have low to moderate income housing that we are able to rent to people based on their income, and really allowing individuals and families to have good quality, affordable housing.
I know if Albany's like the rest of the cities, especially the big cities in Georgia and America, you're probably struggling to keep up with infrastructure projects. And how has the city utilized federal funds programs to do that?
Well, we have several federally funded programs. Some are related to infrastructure. We have an airport, so we receive significant FTA funding for our airport. We run a transit system. We receive significant funding for our transit system. But in addition to that, we have a lot of aged infrastructure in our community. And I like to tell people what is underneath the surface matters. And we have an aged sewer system, for example. We have parts of our sewer system that are over 100 years old. So we just recently leveraged a GFA loan, and Georgia Environmental Financing Authority loan is actually federal funding administered by the state. We leveraged a $15 million loan at 0.75%.
And if cuts in federal programs meant that you didn't have access to those kinds of things, what kind of impact would that have on the city of Albany?
It would be major for the city because, again, so many of our programs are helping those who are economically disadvantaged. You know, you took transit. If we didn't have federal funding and transit went away, people couldn't get to work. People couldn't get to school. The infrastructure piece would be huge for us. And, you know, we're actually looking to leverage more federal dollars through Tiger grants and things like that to help our infrastructure because locally we just cannot afford it. The price tag's too high.
At this point, I should probably go over some definitions and decode the alphabet soup of acronyms you're going to be hearing about in this episode. CDBG is the Community Development Block Grant that we already talked about with Becky Taylor from GMA. The funds come from the Housing and Urban Development Department, that's HUD, and in Georgia, they're distributed either directly to those entitlement or hub cities or distributed by the Georgia Department of Community Affairs through an application process. There are a wide array of uses that these funds can be used for, but infrastructure is a big one. The LMIG, spelled L-M-I-G, is the Local Maintenance and Improvement Grant. These are state funds in Georgia that are distributed by the Georgia Department of Transportation for cities and counties in Georgia to use on their local streets. In Ocilla, we use these each year just to resurface dilapidated city streets. GEFA, spelled G-E-F-A, is the Georgia Environmental Finance Authority. It makes low-interest loans, sometimes offering principal forgiveness, to cities and counties in Georgia for upgrades and improvement primarily on water and wastewater systems. Wastewater is just a fancy word for sewer. And T-grants. These are another example of federal funds that pass through the state, in this case, the Georgia Department of Transportation, and it helps cities and counties make improvements to transportation-related assets, which can include downtown streetscapes, sidewalks, as well as bike lanes and trails. There are others, of course, but these are the main ones used today. The city of Ocilla has actually utilized all of these programs in just my short 2.5 years as their mayor. Like I said before, this is a national level issue, not just something the state of Georgia is dealing with. While Becky Taylor focuses on the delegates in Congress from Georgia on behalf of GMA and its member cities, there's another organization that addresses issues on the federal level and lobbies on behalf of cities across the nation. That organization is the National League of Cities, and they were well represented at GMA's annual convention by someone whose focus is on the exact infrastructure issues we're talking about today.
Hi, I'm Brittany Kohler. I work with the National League of Cities, working on transportation and infrastructure issues across the country.
And for folks that may not know what the National League of Cities does, briefly just tell us what its purpose is.
Sure. So the National League of Cities is meant to bring together city leaders across the country to comment and really push for efforts from the local level all the way up to Congress. How do we move forward the big things that need to happen at the national level so that it actually helps our cities on the ground?
Brittany was there to give a presentation on infrastructure needs nationwide and to brief us on the efforts of the National League of Cities on a campaign that they are calling Rebuild With Us. She spoke with me right after her presentation, and we went through some of the facts and figures.
So at this conference and at many previous conferences, a big subject of conversation is infrastructure needs of cities. I like to focus on small towns because it's a small town podcast, but we're talking about cities of all sizes. So we just heard your presentation at the Federal Policy Council meeting GMA hosted this morning. If you would just hit some of the highlights just to explain to the audience just the size. And you actually, I'll try to paint this picture since we're audio only. You showed a picture of an iceberg. And that really kind of encapsulated the problem. So just speak to some of the infrastructure needs across the board, if you would.
So every city across this country is dealing with an infrastructure need, whether it's a water project or a transportation project, a bridge that's been there since 100 years ago. We have needs across this country. And they're also not only about old infrastructure, but they're about new infrastructure. So what do we need for the future? What does that look like? And how can we build it? Because we know right now in America, we have $4.5 trillion worth of needs. $4.5 trillion. That is a lot. Some of that we have some plans for. Congress has some money they're working from. We recently saw an appropriations package that would put $20 billion additional dollars into existing infrastructure funds. That's great. It helps us move along. But that is the tip of the iceberg when it comes to actually solving America's challenges. And that means solving cities' challenges. From the smallest town in America to the largest town in America, we have to be on top of these issues. And right now, that's what city leaders across the country are doing, is they're calling on Congress to rebuild with them and to really make these investments that make their towns the best place to live and work, whether you're in Georgia or whether you're in Washington. This is a place where we can all agree, where we can all get behind it, and we can all make sure that our economy is moving forward.
So you said 4.5 trillion with a T, and just to put that, I guess, in a time frame, is that what needs to be replaced now? Is that the needs that are coming up in a certain time frame? I just want to dig it. That's a huge number, and I want to make sure we understand what that really means.
It is a huge number, but that's over 10 years, and that's really trying to come up with a comprehensive look at where we need to go. If you don't have a number, how can you plan? And that's really where our cities are today, is they're coming up with great plans that can move their cities forward, but we need to make sure we also have a funding plan for that, and that there's a strong connection between how can the federal government support that local plan, because we know that cities know their needs best. Your citizens tell you about them every day, what needs to be fixed, what maybe needs to be a priority, and that's what we want to see, is a greater connection from the top level down to a city and an everyday Main Street America.
And just to, again, broaden the conversation, a lot of times people say infrastructure, we're thinking streets and we're thinking things that flow through pipes. But some of the categories you discussed in your presentation, it's a lot more than that. So when we say the word infrastructure, dig into the different categories. And if you would, because you had this in your presentation too, some of the categories that have the biggest needs, whether it's because of things currently crumbling and needing to be repaired, or because we are estimating the need because of growth in cities across America.
So I would say the elephant in the room is transportation funding, and that's of all types. So that means your roads, your bridges, your transit, your buses, everyday options for people to move around not only your city, but then all the way across the country. And that's a basic, right? So we're basically falling about $1 trillion behind in the transportation space. And that's something that is just unacceptable. We're just not on top of that need. The second largest category is water. So your basic water infrastructure, your pipes that go under the street all the way to your house. No one wants those water pipes to break. No one wants to be inconvenienced like that, especially a business. That's an issue that's very serious to locals. And we need to make sure we're on top of that one as well. There's also some other funding categories like airports and electricity and water, major water infrastructure like our inland waterway system that runs all the way from Mississippi up to Canada. And there's a lot there. We have a lot of infrastructure in this country, and it's helped our economy for a long time, but it's also getting old. And once it gets to a certain point, you know, you can't expect it to be as young and spry as it used to. And we're going to have to do a lot more repairs. We're just going to have to give it a little bit more tender love and care and make sure that we're keeping it working for the next generation.
Something we end up talking about a lot on my podcast, because it deals with small towns in a lot of rural areas in Georgia, is rural broadband. you actually mentioned broadband as infrastructure. So speak to that one. That one's a little more of a, you're not repairing anything that's broken, you're putting something in that's become very necessary. So speak to that aspect as well.
Rural broadband is absolutely an investment that needs to be made. We need a broadband network that goes across this country, and that it doesn't matter where you live, you can get onto the internet, you can work from home, you can actually do some of the business functions that frankly are made possible through that broadband and that accessibility. There is a lot of agricultural uses for broadband right now that you're seeing across the country, and being able to access those is really critical. We see this as a big investment that could come in an infrastructure package. The National League of Cities is calling for that. We are seeing several bills that could show progress on this area. The challenge, of course, is really making the case for that. And that starts with everyone coming to Congress and saying, we think that this is an opportunity. Here's what we're going to do. Here's what we've planned. How can you help us, Congress? How can we move this forward and make sure that broadband isn't just for big cities? It's for everywhere.
While Brittany gave the wide view of the nation as a whole, Becky Taylor was able to zoom in on Georgia infrastructure needs and its condition.
Last year, GMA did a survey on cities' capital needs. We asked them to report their five-year capital needs for different categories. And what we got back was the information we used to project the total five-year needs, which are estimated about $11.2 billion.
And that's just for Georgia?
Just for Georgia cities. And that's just for the upcoming 5 years. So the greatest category of need is for water and sewer, and that was $3.7 billion over the next 5 years. And it varies on what those funds need to be used for, but in a lot of cases, it's to replace 100-year-old, 50-year-old pipes. I mean, we heard the city of Tennell said that they've had water main breaks for the last several years, but their pipes are 100 years old. I mean, we've had coastal cities that flood every time it rains, and it's a serious issue, just aging infrastructure, but then also trying to deal with projected growth and making sure we're ready for the future. Transportation was the second highest category. Over $2.6 billion is estimated to be needed over the next 5 years, and that's everything from resurfacing and road widening to transit, road safety, congestion. I mean, it kind of varies as whether you're looking at metro areas where the issue is more along lines of congestion. But transportation supports our rural economy as well. It connects the Port of Savannah to every place in Georgia. I mean, it's really important that we take care of the needs in that area.
Well, I just know even from our region, the demand and the conversation to take a two-lane highway to a four-lane highway because of the influx of trucks to get products in and out. And of course, if you got a rural agriculture-based economy, you're growing something that needs to be transported out, and obviously the raw materials to help grow those things have to be transported in. So I wouldn't have thought that as much, but I live in a rural area now as a local official. Those are the things we end up talking about, just to widen a road for safety and congestion and making sure some of those trucks can be supported on some of the roads we've got. So yeah,
that's right. All the transportation network supports jobs, our economy, education, it all kind of ties in together. With transportation funding, we have to also remember that the Highway Trust Fund is not going to support our needs into the future. So when we talk to members of Congress, we ask them to let us know what they think is going to happen with the gas tax. Are we going to have to increase the gas tax to be able to pay for what we need over the next decade and into the future? And, you know, what other alternatives are being explored? But we must, you know, try to figure out a way to pay for those things.
Now describe, just for an audience member that, well, for me, who doesn't know some of these things, the Highway Trust Fund, how does that work? How is it funded? And, you know, if it goes out, what are the repercussions of that?
Every time we buy a gallon of gas, a portion of the taxes on there is federal taxes, and that all goes into the Federal Highway Trust Fund. And the funds would be distributed back to states for transportation needs. But for years, that fund hasn't had sufficient money in it to pay for transportation needs. Everybody, every state is subsidized by basically the general fund at the federal level. So we have to figure out some way that makes more sense to pay for transportation needs.
So like so many other things, the program that was set up just hasn't kept pace with the increased cost, whether that's because of need or inflation or a combination of both.
I can't remember the last time it was raised. I think it was in the 90s, the last time that they raised the gas tax at the federal level. So they are looking at different things like vehicle miles traveled and different ways, you know, technology that they can track how many miles that we've driven and, you know, pay per mile or something like that. But regardless of what the solution is, there will probably be more than one solution, but we have to remember to keep talking about that, because we have to pay for the things that we appropriate funds for. It has to come from somewhere. There's also needs for public safety. Stormwater is a big need. But then cities also work not just on the things that are kind of hidden that we take for granted, but on innovative projects too. Revitalizing our downtowns, creating areas that are just walkable and where people would want to come and live, and downtown improvements, green infrastructure investment, all those things are really important and in a lot of cases unique to cities. We not only have to deal with sort of the not so sexy things, but we deal with things that make our communities attractive and keep people living there and keep people wanting to come back.
Yep.
Just in terms of needs and kind of where we are with infrastructure in Georgia, every year the American Society of Civil Engineers does a what they call a report card of infrastructure state by state. And the last report card for Georgia was done in 2014. At that time, they said that Georgia's overall score was a C, with a C in drinking water, C minus in roads, D plus in stormwater, and D minus in transit. If we fail to address those kinds of things, that jeopardizes the public's health and safety. Yeah. It threatens our state's economy. So it's really important that we get our grades up.
Yeah, that's a good way to say that. And certainly we've seen examples across the nation where, you know, we have some serious dilapidated wastewater and, of course, drinking water.
Yeah.
And, of course, that has a huge impact on just public health, period, not to mention the economic impacts that will happen for years, just even as how things are marketed. If you have something like that happen, then it's going to be years before someone's really interested in coming to your area and establishing business and inviting people to move there and work there. So, absolutely.
Hi, I'm Boyd Austin, mayor of the city of Dallas, Georgia.
And what's the population of Dallas, Georgia?
About 15,000, somewhere close by. Well, we've been very fortunate on our LMIG program. It's very important to us for our paving of our local streets. We also have received several T grants where we've built trails and alternative modes of transportation into some of our natural areas. So those funds are real important to us at a local level, and they continue to change the names and the programs occasionally. I just hope they don't quit providing the funds for those things. Each community is different and has different needs, and those funds all help match the needs of the individual communities with their local priorities.
Hi, my name is Liz McLean. I'm the city manager of McRae Helena. We have a population of about 8,700. Infrastructure has kind of been the forefront of what projects we've been doing the past 3 years, because we used to be two separate cities. And then in 2015, we consolidated two city governments. And at that time, we had to create a foundation for our government, and infrastructure was kind of the most natural place to start, because we wanted to have a uniform street system. We wanted to have uniform water, uniform sewer. And it was actually a $1.8 million wastewater project that was funded through GFA that was the impetus of our consolidation. So infrastructure has always been an important feature of our new McRae Helena government. Another one of the first projects that we worked on was a CDBG for a water tower. It improved the water pressure in an area of town that had, I couldn't tell you what the water pressure was at the time, but we had a very low water tower. And McRae had two that were about 180 feet. So we wanted to make that uniform and bring that water pressure to the Helena side of town as well. And we would not have been able to do that without the CDBG project. We got that and finished it in 2015. So now we have applied for a CDBG that will connect our two water systems and create a uniform product that our utility service is giving out. Without those funds, those projects might never have come to fruition. They may never happen, because we have to use our utility revenues for our maintenance and operations. And so it's really hard to do those capital outlay projects without that special funding. LMIG has been a huge help, because last year between LMIG and TIA, we paved about 12% of our city's roads, which was unheard of. Everyone kept coming to us saying, we have never seen this much paving, this much improvement. We were able to pave dirt roads that haven't been paved, you know, and that's a huge thing in small southern towns. In city limits, you still have dirt roads. So we use that funding to pave those and improve the quality of life.
We've talked about the scope of the issue and some of the greatest needs at the national level and at the state level for Georgia, but I wanted to bring this down to the local level as well. Beyond hearing from city officials who deal with the financing and the execution of the infrastructure improvement and maintenance projects,
I wanted to talk with someone who gets even closer to the issue, sometimes quite literally. All right, I'm now joined by Chad Griffin, engineer who's actually done some projects in my fair city of Osceola, as well as many others. We're going to be talking to him about that exact thing today, about infrastructure. So, Chad, thanks for joining us on Small Town Podcast.
Glad to be here. Thanks for the opportunities in Osceola as well.
Just want to start out just giving the audience a little bit of a scope of the types of things you do. And I know, you know, I actually am going to enjoy learning on this because I think you've done plenty of things beyond what you've done on the few projects in Osceola. So, what are, I guess, the bread and butter of the projects you do at Stillwaters Engineering?
Stillwaters Engineering is a full-service engineering service. And when I say full service is we find out where cities have problems. We try to help them with engineering solutions. We also try to help them with funding. We try to take a project from beginning to end and help our client get the solutions to solve that problem.
So what are some of the, I guess, main categories of work that you do?
Main categories are water, wastewater, roads, elevated tanks, land application systems. Everything that a municipality could encounter, I've probably dealt with in my career.
And we're talking today on this episode about infrastructure and really just the infrastructure needs. And as we kind of get into that, I know, obviously, you and I have talked about some of the other small towns you've been in. What's the population of the smallest town you've ever done some infrastructure projects in? And what would be the population of the largest town, just so people can kind of see the full range of the types of work you do?
We work with cities as small as 100, 100 citizens, and as large as we work with cities 25 to 70,000.
Okay.
Yeah.
So from 100 to 70,000, that is a pretty wide range. That's actually quite a wider range than I would have expected. And are you seeing, and this is just, I'm just curious, are you seeing the same types of issues when you're dealing with that, or are they just different issues? What do you see in kind of city to city?
That's amazing because no matter if it's 100 citizens or 70,000, they still have the same problems. We've mm-hmm. worked with communities of those sizes that have wastewater problems. We've worked with cities of those sizes that have elevated tank problems. So we've worked with lots of cities, and no matter how big or small, a lot of them have infrastructure problems. Matt, we have seen lots of problems throughout. We work in South and Central Georgia, and we see aging infrastructure across the board. And when I say across the board, I mean in sewer systems, I mean in water systems. We see sewer systems that are 70 and 80 years old that are falling apart. We see wastewater. We see water systems that have asbestos cement piping.
Oh, wow.
We see lead services, which has been obviously in the news with Flint, Michigan. Mm-hmm. We see those. We see lots of problems. And what our goal is, our engineering firm's goal is to try to line that community up with the best funding source to try to help fix that infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. I imagine, because I mean, this is the case for the city of Osceola. I imagine in most cases, especially smaller towns, but you probably say this about any size city, they would not be able to do some of these projects without those funding sources.
Funding is crucial. Without funding, these projects, because of the sheer cost, size, magnitude of them, it's impossible for a community to tax or to get rates high enough to take care of these. Grant funds / loans that are over 15, 20, 30 year time frames are crucial.
Yeah.
Without programs like GFA, USDA, a lot of these infrastructure improvements just would never get done.
I actually wanted to ask you very specifically to help me with a definition, because I've heard some people talk about having infiltration mm-hmm. in the sewer, and I know what that is, but I know you'll be able to explain it better because you're an engineer. So explain to the audience what infiltration is and why it impacts, how it impacts a sewer system, because that seems to be something people are talking about a lot that's causing headaches.
I&I is a catchphrase that gets dropped tremendous whether you go to any presentation. You hear people talk about, my sewer has I&I in it. Well, I&I is inflow and infiltration. Infiltration is water that's getting into that sewer system through cracks, through leaks, through improper installation methods.
And you're just talking about groundwater, water after a rain, that kind of thing is what's getting into the sewer pipes?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Those things become huge issues for a community, any community that has to treat that, because all of that sewer travels downstream to your wastewater treatment facility, which in turn you have to treat, which in turn you have a permit for.
Mm-hmm.
And your permit is for a certain limit. So if you have holes all in your sewer, your permit limit will be exceeded. You're also spending more money to treat that wastewater. Those are huge issues for all of us in Georgia.
So let's talk a minute about the cost, because that's what I really wanted to kind of get from talking to an engineer. And I remember when I first became a mayor, pretty soon after that, we did our LMIG, our street reconstruction. And I remember learning and being a little bit shocked, just because I had nothing to base it off, that just to resurface a street that was already a street, not new construction, but just to take up the asphalt and put it down. Every tenth of a mile cost about $10,000 just to do a pretty simple asphalt resurfacing. So that's $100,000 per mile of resurfacing streets. And that's when it kind of gave me that, oh gosh, it really costs a lot to maintain things. So when it comes to water and sewage, I know that the costs are even higher because we've talked about some of the stuff for Osceola. So what, as much as you can, and I know there's a lot of variables, how much does it cost, maybe say for sewer? We're supposed to say wastewater, but it's sewer. So what does that cost to rehab, to replace, to do whatever to sewer in a city, small or large? It costs the same per however many miles or blocks or whatever.
Sewer, wastewater is the most expensive.
Oh, yeah.
Is by far the most expensive. It will blow your doors off when start talking about rehab and sewer. If you look at a typical community like Osceola, if you're trying to rehab or replace a mile of sewer, you're probably looking in the $500,000 to $600,000 range, which is amazing when you start thinking about how many miles a typical city like Osceola has.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you next, because I know this about Osceola, so we'll leave it at Osceola. 2.6 square miles is the size, not a very large town, about 3,400 in population. So I don't know if you've looked at, you've probably seen enough of this, you could at least shoot from the hip, give me an estimate. How many miles of sewer pipe do you think exist in my 2.6 square mile city?
City of Osceola's probably got 40 to 50 miles of sewer main.
Wow.
And probably that sewer main was put in 50s and 60s. Which means a lot of it probably needs to be rehabbed.
Well, we've replaced a little bit.
We have replaced some.
We got some more to go. So, okay. So 50 to 60 miles, or did you say 40?
40 to 50, probably.
40 to 50 miles of sewer pipes, and every mile of that costs about $500,000 to replace. Somewhere in that, obviously, it depends on a lot of different things.
That's correct.
That's amazing.
Right. Water is, if you want to kind of keep it in the same relation, trying to figure out water and sewer and how much infrastructure, water is much cheaper.
Yeah.
Water would probably be in the $200,000 to $150,000 range for a mile.
Per mile.
But still very expensive.
Now, does that include, because I mean, that's just for the pipe, but I know in Osceola we have what are called lift stations to make sure the wastewater goes the direction it's supposed to and just keeps going and kind of moves things along. Literally. So does that include some of those things too? Or that's just the pipe?
That's just the pipe.
Okay.
That's pipe, manholes, and maybe service lines.
Because I know some of our lift stations are in the $60,000 to $70,000 range if we were going to replace them. And we've got nine of those and then one really big lift station at the end of the line to push it the rest of the way.
I'd say your lift stations are probably $70,000 to $100,000 each to replace.
Wow.
We've done a lot of that sewer rehab lately.
I bet you've got an example of where things just got really severe. And what happens, and I don't know if that may mean EPD action, because I've talked to some people that have had, I think it's called a consent order. What's the situation where you just saw it get bad because there was no plan, because, you know, people did punt? And I don't want you to say the name of the city if you've got an especially drastic example.
Yeah, everyone will remain nameless. But we've seen several situations where EPD, the Environmental Protection Division, gets involved, and there's potential lawsuits that are involved as well, because a community may be outside of their permit. They may not can add another customer because of that consent.
Yeah, I've heard of cases where, I guess it's a consent order, but people are not allowed to add on to provide another tap for either water or sewer or both.
So you literally can't grow your city until you fix your infrastructure.
Right.
And that's what the EPD is wanting you to do, is to fix it. We have seen communities before where they've had sewer systems that are 70 years old. And because of that old sewer system and the I&I that we mentioned just briefly ago, it was overloading their sewer system, which in turn was going downstream to their wastewater treatment facility, which was causing them to be in violation. Because of that, their permit was always out. The EPD got involved with these communities and said, basically, you're going to fix this, and you've got X amount of time to do this. They didn't care where the money came from, but it had to be fixed.
So you've got an audience of a lot of small-town folks and then several local leaders, whether they're elected or appointed. What advice, from an engineering standpoint, would you want to give to them regarding infrastructure and how to, I guess, keep from some of the problems and some of the costs we're talking about?
One thing that we always suggest is communication. Communicate with your engineer, your utility director. We want to talk to him. We want to hear his shopping list of things that he would love to see accomplished in his community. And what we want to do is then take that shopping list and form a comprehensive plan. I urge all communities, mayors, councils, boards, utility directors get together a comprehensive plan. Comprehensive plan will basically take your group, your council, and it will help them direct where funds need to go in the future. We want to make sure that comprehensive plans are in place because we want to prioritize what the biggest needs are.
I know they say an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I imagine that actually applies very well to infrastructure needs.
We want to be proactive and not reactive in all infrastructure improvements.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Chad, thanks so much for giving us some good information and just sharing it with us and some of the experiences getting really close to that infrastructure. And thanks for being a part of Small Town Podcast.
Matt, thank you so much. Stillwater's Engineering is also available to help with any of these infrastructure improvements. And we also appreciate all your time, Matt. Thank you.
Good pitch. All right.
Bill Yurt, I'm the mayor of Sylvester, Georgia.
And what's the population of Sylvester?
The population's around 6,200.
And talk about what you've been able to do because of programs like LMIG and CDBG, and if you've gotten some T grants, federal funds that help you with infrastructure in your small town.
Sure. The LMIG has been very positive in our community, and we put it to good use. And actually, one LMIG project that we're working on now is widening and improving the road that several of our large industries are on. So it's a very important program that we use to benefit citizens as well as economic development in our community.
And what would be the impact on your city if federal funding got cut or some of those programs went away?
It would be very detrimental. Another program that we have used very successfully has been the CDBG program. We have pretty well gotten funding for every time we've applied, which you can apply every other year. So we've been very successful. One reason is our staff does a great job of implementing those programs. We've used it to improve our infrastructure, mainly water and sewer projects. We've done some other projects in the community, but the main ones have been water and sewer projects. And actually, when I became mayor, we were under a consent order from EPD. We were having so much infiltration into our sewer system. We had the old terracotta pipes that had been there for 100 years, and there was so much groundwater and stormwater going into our system that we were under a consent order where we actually could not hook up new sewage and could not offer new infrastructure to industries coming to our community. So we took advantage of the CDBG program to improve our system. We're not there yet, but we've gotten better than halfway into improving our aged system, and that's been very important to our community.
So what would you have to do if they cut those programs and stop funding CDBG programs?
It would be very difficult. In a small rural community, our tax base is very limited. Our property taxes would not nearly cover the cost of those infrastructure improvements. So it's very important that they remain available to a community like Sylvester and other rural communities to make our infrastructure improvements that we need to attract industry and to serve our citizens.
Hi, I'm Lee Gowan. I'm the mayor of the great city of Folkestone, Georgia, very, very southeastern Georgia. On the eastern side of the Okefenokee Swamp, we are known to be the train-watching capital of the world. We have the Folkestone Funnel, where two train lines coming out of Georgia converge together and go on into Florida and service the eastern side of Florida. So we have like up to 60 trains a day that come through Folkestone. We have a lot of train watchers, a lot of folks that like to go to the Okefenokee Swamp. Well, at this point in time, we actually, believe it or not, and Osceola may have this too, we actually still have a few areas, residential areas, in the city of Folkestone that still have dirt roads and need some paving projects and drainage projects. And without CDBG, we just can't do them. But we don't get enough money on LMIG. There's a possibility now that we've passed the regional T-SPLOS that we will be able to do some of those projects that we haven't been able to do before with the 25% allocation. But that's still up in the air too. You know, we've got a lot of other projects. Some of our main streets in the city of Folkestone are crumbling because of the truck traffic that we get. Our main street and our third street are big projects that we're going to be looking at doing. Some of these small projects in the residential areas and in what I would call the lower income areas, but because of populations or because of the income level of, like I said, one family, we just don't qualify for the CDBG and like to see an alternative to the current CDBG.
So even though we are looking at this issue broadly across the entire state of Georgia and even taking a national view, I can't help but give a little bit of focus on rural communities. We've already referenced rural issues and the unique challenges they face with regard to infrastructure, as well as some of the specialized programs that are meant to assist in meeting those challenges. But many people think of big infrastructure issues as being mostly in metropolitan areas, since increasing populations have put a heavy strain on the aging infrastructure of all categories in some of those large cities.
But to get a rural perspective statewide, I wanted to speak with a person who oversees what is still Georgia's number one industry, agriculture.
I'm now joined by the Agriculture Commissioner of the great state of Georgia, Mr. Gary Black. I'm actually sitting in his office. So, Commissioner Black, thanks for having me and inviting me into your office today.
Matt, we're glad to see you today and excited about your project here and the opportunity to visit with your listeners.
I asked Commissioner Black to discuss how infrastructure impacts various aspects of agriculture in Georgia.
Maybe the best place to talk about that is within cotton. Okay, we're in Georgia's number two cotton producing state in the nation. Significant impact on Georgia cotton going abroad. I mean, significant portion of our cotton is exported each year. 60 plus gins in the state of Georgia, and they're employing people, and most, good many of them are farmer owned, so the farmers own the stock. It's a huge component of its number one row crop in Georgia. It's cotton. Okay, I can think back when my hair was not as white as it is, considerably browner. And as a young person in the capital, younger, we saw it was a strategic decision that Georgia made that we're going to participate in the federal program to eradicate the boll weevil. We always had some cotton in Georgia, but we were ravaged in the Dust Bowl days and moving up through the 40s and 50s and 60s. And really just, you know, we had some concentrated areas of the state where the cotton was grown, but it was not statewide because of the boll weevil. So we enter into it. We make a decision. We think we can grow more cotton in Georgia, so let's participate in the federal program to eradicate the boll weevil. We did that. A good vision took place to actually take those steps. I can remember going, I think it was 1994, 95, we had a funeral for the boll weevil at Sunbelt Ag Expo down in Moultrie. I mean, literally, we had the boll weevil in a casket. And everybody was celebrating. But it was also, that was one of the very first things I can remember in lobbying of having to, where we sort of outkicked our coverage. Because we went from, you know, from 0 to 60 very fast in the industry. We built a lot of gins. We expanded to over 1 million acres of cotton. But we'd not thought strategically that, wow, the way cotton is taken to market now is through this thing called a module builder and a module truck. And the module truck is designed with a tandem axle in the back and a single axle in the front. And the tandem axle weight was 42,000 pounds. Or more. But then county roads and state roads in Georgia at that time was 36,340, if I remember, maybe 38,340. And so
less than the
truck. Way we were transporting way. Our product, we were illegally immediately. And we had to work with the legislature and Department of Transportation to get those policies changed so you could raise those tandem axle weights. There's been some ongoing elevation of that from 42 to 46, and I think there's a little tolerance even built into the 46, if I remember correctly. But gross vehicle weight still stayed at 80,000 pounds. But there's a perfect infrastructure example of how we wanted to grow agriculture. We wanted to build it, and boy, we were really excited. We've got the cotton industry back, but wow, we've got to make sure we get these trucks. And then that definitely has an impact on rural bridges, quality of rural roads, and then how, you know, you get back to local decision makers, that it puts a lot on their plate. But
right.
I think that's why we've got to think a little more strategically. There's many, many more things we can do in Georgia, but there certainly are a lot of moving parts when it comes to getting a product from the field to the marketplace. And that one example is something I think we've pretty much solved in now, but it was interesting in those early days.
Well, even with transportation now, I mean, as things continue to grow, your capacity has to grow with it. Logistical capacity, I guess I should say.
Yeah, I had a call last week. I don't think it's important to talk about where it was, but the community really needs a new bridge. They're going to get a new bridge. That plan's underway, but now some local people have, primarily Cotton Peanut, have kind of come to the table. They've been invited to a meeting. They heard about it. Wow, they're planning to shut this bridge down, which what I've been told is probably about a 15-mile diversion. Now, 15-mile diversion during harvest season, what does that do to the safety of those other roads? I don't know. I don't know what the route has been proposed, but I know that our friends at DOT are there to kind of talking about that. On DOT board members has listened, and I don't know what the outcome's going to be, but it's just that's another one of those, there'll be good cases made on both sides. I'm sure they'll make a wise decision. It's just interesting that when we have this one decision to make an investment, that it actually there is a ripple effect. Mm-hmm. And so I'm interested to see what the outcome of that deal is going to be.
Then we shifted to a subject near and dear to Commissioner Black's heart.
Let's move on to rural broadband. Because when I asked you about sitting down and talking, that was the thing you were most interested in talking about, and for good reason. It's gotten a lot of attention in our recent legislative session in Georgia. Just talk about, because I think for folks that are either not involved in agriculture or maybe just don't live in a place where there's any agriculture, they think, oh, no. Farmers don't rely on that at all. So just let's enlighten folks that may not have the idea of how much of a – and the people are starting to refer to it as a utility because it's much more of a necessity. When it started out and you had dial-up and you could check some email and that was great, that was different. It wasn't quite as much of a necessity, but it certainly has become so in – every part of our life, and agriculture is no different. So just enlighten the folks that may not understand how vital that is.
Matt, one of the fun parts of this job is traveling the state, and part of the being at a Rotary here or a Kiwanis here or Exchange Club, and we get to do that quite a bit. Last month, I was at the Rotary Club in Buckhead. The Morning Rotary Club of Buckhead, and I'm not talking about Greene County Buckhead. I'm talking about
the district north of Atlanta.
That's right. Great people. Actually, a couple of people in there are subscribers to our market bulletin, so our 100-year-old newspaper here. We had some real good friends there. I love asking a group like that, okay, would somebody want to guess of all the peanuts and the cotton and the corn and soybeans and vegetables that are planted in the state of Georgia this year? When the farmer is on the tractor with the planter and he's planting that crop, what percentage of farmers' hands are on the steering wheel as he is doing that? Of course, you'll get several people with all of them. I mean, why has the tractor... And, of course, that number is probably north of 90% this year did not have their hands on the steering wheel.
Wow.
Because the tractor has a guidance system. It is GPS. It is satellite-driven. That tractor is collecting data on every pass, and that's meshed with the data that the farm supplier, the fertilizer dealer, has based upon pH and soil nutrients, and then the data that you're collecting when the cotton picker or the combine is coming across the field, because it's collecting data of what the yield was in a certain part. And so everything is prescriptive in agriculture now. We're in a time where we don't have grandma's recipe. It's not granddad's recipe of how to farm anymore. It is the prescription of how to farm. And so that comes with a lot of technology. And it's how you integrate and be able to capitalize on all that technology is certainly connectivity driven. So that's one of the key parts of that. I have another personal example. My daughter and my son-in-law are building a house in North Habersham County. She works for a farm in North Hall County. She's the marketing director. He has his own business. He's been very successful. It is a internet-driven marketing platform, largely marketing through social media. You have the inability to, right now, where they're building their house. They just bought a 55-acre farm in North Habersham County, and the estimates to run the bandwidth that he needs is $100,000.
Woo.
Now, he's not going to do that. That's going to hamper their... it doesn't mean that his facility where he operates will still be in Hall County and still has capability, but his problem is connectivity, working out of his home office, which he would love to do with his plant. That's a perfect example of how if we want rural Georgia to participate in the 21st century economy, that rural broadband, its expansion, hopefully working with the president's initiative for rural prosperity, and certainly some of the things that Georgia General Assembly is productive things that have happened with the General Assembly to expand broadband in Georgia. It's unthinkable that we would not take every step now so that this next generation can prosper and so that rural Georgia doesn't get left behind.
And do you think, again, it could be dramatic, and I don't mean to do it, it is what it is. Do you think there's a danger that if we, either as a state or certain areas of the state even, don't make the necessary steps for infrastructure maintenance and improvements, and maybe very specifically to rural broadband, the examples you gave are you know, very telling. If we don't do those things, we have this thriving industry in agriculture and the value-added businesses, the agritourism, all the things we've talked about. Do you think we're in danger of maybe falling behind and not having some of those rankings and some of those impacts? Not that something else would replace it, because another industry just got bigger, which wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing, but that agriculture would just not be the strength that it is now in Georgia.
Well, Georgia leads in so many areas, and certainly we are the number one place in America to do business and have been five consecutive years, and I don't expect that to change this year. We've got to make sure that our border competitors and we've got 49 other competitors in the United States, and Georgia doesn't want to be left behind. We need a lead. We need to take, and you know, this needs to be the priority of this generation. This connectivity can be a reality. It's absolutely, I know it's frustrating in many corners of the state with our schools, with our, so much of the connectivity within, even in the high school classroom. So much more we could do if that connectivity was available at home. Because otherwise, you know, it's absurd. Somebody doesn't have service at their home. They got to go to public library, library, or a hotspot in order to apply to go to the University of Georgia or go to one of the technical schools or technical colleges. So, and stories like that are all over. There, we all know them. We probably know someone who's had that experience.
But yeah.
I'm hopeful. I'm not the magician that has all those. I am hopeful that we put every skill set that's available in future administrations and just bring everybody to the table to try to solve this. Georgia needs to lead in this. We're doing a lot of good. I'm not really interested in Georgia being 18th in this endeavor.
All right, I want to ask this question. I don't mean to ask it specifically to be dramatic, but it may be. Since so much of the funding that allows especially small communities like mine to make improvements and even upgrades to roads and other aspects, bridges, you've already mentioned bridges, other parts of the transportation system. Then, of course, money that passes through our Department of Community Affairs for community development block grants or CDBG projects that are very often infrastructure related. If that funding were to dry up, how do you see that impacting the agriculture industry as a whole or even specific sectors of it?
That's the way the current business model works. And so I think the first way to address that, or the argument to be made, is, okay, what is the alternative? Because the resources have to, somebody has to pay the bill. If you're going to have investment in the local community, then what's the business model that best suited to meet those needs? And so if some of the current model was to go away, then how is it replaced? Is that, I don't know if you've fully put that burden back on small rural communities, it's never going to happen.
Cam Jordan with the City of Fitzgerald, Georgia. We're a population of about 9,000 in the center of South Georgia. Our big issue right now is that I'd like to address is broadband. We've worked for the last 5 years to secure a TV studio in Fitzgerald. And the last year, the biggest delay we had was getting the broadband connectivity that they needed to get back to Atlanta to hit the satellite link. This is a show that reaches over 500,000 people on three different satellite channels. And they broadcast live 12 hours a week. It's about 25 full-time jobs in our city. They're building studios for another show. It was like pulling hen's teeth to get the broadband connectivity we needed. The cable company said they would do it, and then, 9 months later, there was nothing. We had to go to the president of the telephone company for the whole state of Georgia to finally get them to get involved. And it's extremely difficult for us to be able to grow the kind of industry we need. We've got five industries right now that would hook up tomorrow if we had the broadband connectivity that we need in rural South Georgia.
Now, all of this discussion on the reliance on federal funds could be characterized as local leaders, just like myself, just looking for someone else to fix our problems for us. First of all, you should know that we at the local level have to provide matching funds in order to receive any of these grants. Now, that may not convince some of you that this is a good way to manage tax dollars, but as Commissioner Black stated, This is the current business model, and if we're going to do away with any of the funds or the structure in which we allocate these funds, we had better come up with an alternative. I'll remind you that the National League of Cities is calling on Congress to rebuild with us, not to rebuild for us. It is a request for partnership where all sides have to step up and have skin in the game. In Georgia, there are several examples of state, regional, and local governments stepping up to deal with infrastructure issues. Perhaps the most notable recent example involves big changes that have been made in the area of transportation over the last several years. As it turns out, I happen to know someone who's been, and continues to be, at the center of these changes in how Georgia handles its transportation infrastructure needs, the Director of Planning for the Georgia Department of Transportation. All right, I'm now in the office on the 22nd floor in the office of the Director of Planning, Mr. Jay Roberts. I should say this, too. This was funny. Jay's our former state representative from Osceola, all of Irwin County, as well as several other counties, but obviously Osceola was his favorite. And so he still lives there, even though he works a good bit in Atlanta. Obviously, I live in Osceola, and so two guys from Osceola ended up getting together in Atlanta just to have a conversation on a recording. So, Jay Roberts, thanks for joining us on Small Town Podcast.
Yeah, listen, glad to be here. Like you said, it's kind of ironic that here we are in the big city of Atlanta, and both of us are small town boys. But listen, it's okay. This is where it's happening at right now here at GDOT, and we've got a lot of good things moving forward here with the state of Georgia.
Well, yeah, and I want to talk about some of those. We're talking pretty specifically about infrastructure. We're talking about where the funds come from, and I was telling you before we started recording, I was surprised to learn why we think of the Georgia Department of Transportation is who does all and all the funds come from the state level. There's actually a surprising amount that comes at the federal level. So if you could just take a minute and explain, you know, big picture, how that works and where it comes from and what that has to do. And obviously, GDOT ends up working as a steward for those funds. But increasingly, over the last several years, and you've been at the center of all this, Georgia has done a lot for itself to improve and maintain its own transportation system. So speak to that a little bit. Give us a little education on how that works.
Sure. In 2015, when I was in the legislature as chairman of the Transportation Committee, we actually passed House Bill 170, which was actually an increase in the motor fuel tax and a few other fees that actually increased GDOT's budget from the state level standpoint by about $1 billion. To give you an example, had we not passed HB 170 back in 2015, this past year we would have actually taken about a $300 million hit to our budget, because prior to HB 170, we had a sales tax portion that was based off the average price of a gallon of gas every 6 months that was adjusted. So on that 4%, it adjusted up and down, and as most of us know, gas prices has been down, so it would have adjusted downward. So had we not passed HB 170, we would have had about a $1.3 billion difference in our budget compared to where we are today.
And while I know everyone wants to pay less for gas, we still got to find a way to fix the roads.
Absolutely. I mean, infrastructure is the basis behind economic development, is the basis behind growth. And when you look at Georgia, especially when you look at the port in Savannah, you look at the Hartsfield-Jackson, Atlanta in general, we're the economic engine of the Southeast United States.
That's right.
And so therefore, we've got to make sure that our infrastructure is in place. And prior to the passage of HB 170, we didn't have the infrastructure. We didn't have the money to repair that infrastructure. Just our regular maintenance was down. I think Governor Deal said it best when he gave his State of the State in 2015. If your road was paved when you graduated high school, the next time it would be repaved or resurfaced was when you collected Social Security.
Wow.
So that was basically the rotation that we were looking at. We didn't have the funds. And prior to HB 170, let me say this. We were about 60% reliant on the federal government and 40% on state. It's even at some point was 65-35. So we were heavily reliant on the federal government for our money here in the state of Georgia when it comes to transportation. And if you've paid any attention to the federal government over the last several years, you know that they haven't done a lot at the federal level, transportation being one of those. We were getting constantly continuing resolutions that may be a 2-month authorization or 3-month authorization. We were happy to get a 6-month authorization or even a year, you know, and that makes it hard to plan when you start trying to look, because the way the federal program is, we pay it forward. We pay and then feds reimburse us. So if we've spent our state dollars trying to get our federal dollars drawn down, and then we don't get reimbursed because of those continuing resolutions, we run out of money. And so therefore, you may see a letting that happens 1 month or 2 months out of the year waiting for that federal payback, more or less, where our lettings are very low. Or we may not have a letting because we're waiting for Congress or the federal government to authorize the funds to come back to us.
While Georgia has, in some respects, taken transportation infrastructure matters into its own hands, Jay Roberts told us that Georgia still receives around $1 billion a year in federal funds for transportation, but they are specified for certain types of maintenance and improvements, and those categories come with some restrictions and requirements. This can be especially challenging for small towns.
And then you get down to a fund code that is 5,000 or less population where you would spend it in a city like Ocala, Georgia. But having said that, when you start looking at that, it's tough to spend those federal dollars in those areas of 5,000 or less population simply because of all the strings that are attached to a federal dollar.
Right.
That is probably one of the biggest issues we have, is spending the dollars in the different buckets and being able to get through those regulations. Bottom line is, if you have a federal dollar attached to a project, then you can figure on roughly around about a 30 to 40% increase in cost in that project simply because time's money, mm-hmm. and it takes longer time mm-hmm. to be able to complete a project with federal dollars because you got to jump through all the environmental hoops.
Well, I was just going to say, in my neck of the woods, a lot of the folks talk about how it increases the cost and the time because of just that one thing, environmental studies.
It absolutely does. One of the things that the Trump administration is trying to do is do away with some of those regulations to streamline that process. I had the opportunity several times this past year to go to the White House and talk about infrastructure. And that's one of the things that they were really looking at doing, is how do we streamline this process? As well as, the interesting thing is, if we have 99% of the dollars state dollars and 1% of them federal dollars, we have to follow the whole federal process, mm-hmm. which is absolutely ridiculous. And that's one of the things that we're working on with the feds as well. There's some technical terms, but the bottom line is, our argument is, if we have over 50% state dollars invested in it, then why should we have to follow the whole federal process when right. you're not contributing the majority of the money? So those are some of the things that's being looked at as well. But the federal program as a whole really is a burdensome program to deal with. And that's why most projects, when you start talking with local governments from cities and counties, they would rather have state dollars attached to it because then they don't have to go through the different processes. One of the things that we have tried to do here at GDOT is to use our federal dollars a lot for our maintenance type projects. In other words, for our resurfacing and those types of projects, because we're staying within the existing right-of-way and existing footprint, and we're not going outside of that. So therefore, we don't have to go through all those different federal regulations and all to be able to get those projects done, and we can get them done quicker by doing that. Now, unfortunately, we still have to spend federal dollars on other projects as well around the state, which requires us to go through that.
So let me clarify, because earlier you were talking about the funding split, what comes to the federal level and then what comes to the state level, and that amount, the percentage from the federal government used to be 60% and now it's more like 40%. Is that because they've actually reduced funding or because of some of the changes you mentioned in House Bill 170 that we've actually just increased so much the percentage has changed because of our part?
No, that's because of the increase in revenue that we've received from HB 170. It's because the state decided that this was an important issue to us. We had to put more money into infrastructure, and so therefore with the passage of HB 170, that's why those percentages have really flipped, because of the extra money that we now have coming in, or the increased revenue that we've got coming in from HB 170. The feds really haven't cut the amount they're giving us,
right,
but
it's just state,
we've got more state dollars.
The reason we're doing more and we got the bigger percentage as a state of Georgia is because of our part.
Absolutely.
And I think that's an important point, because I guess I'll editorialize a little bit here. I don't know that it would be appropriate for any state or any local government to go to the state or whatever the higher level is and say, oh, we need more, we need all of it to come from you. And that was a pretty good step for Georgia to step forward and say, hey, we're not going to rely on anybody else. We're going to figure out at least how to do this in part for ourselves. So going back to you were talking about some of the streamlining. So it sounds like while more money would be great,
sure.
no one should turn it down, something other than money is what you would, from your position, would like to see from the federal government as far as streamlining some of the regulations on.
Sure.
And so that would be the bigger ask.
Absolutely. I mean, we, and naturally, you know, everybody would like to have more money.
Sure, sure.
But we've actually said that, you know, if you would just reduce some of the regulations and the red tape that we've had, that would actually save us money, because then it's not costing us as much to jump through all those different hoops. And I'll give you an example. We had an issue up in North Georgia. We were looking at building a road, and there was an Indiana bat The Indiana bat is a bat
migrated
that,
to Georgia. Huh? It,
well, supposedly, they
oh, no.
actually had some radio transponders, and one flew close to the border of the state of Georgia. So then Fish and Wildlife says that we have to go in and do all this research and all to see if we have Indiana bats in the state of Georgia. So we've spent about $4 million, roughly, maybe a little more, trying to figure out if we've got an Indiana bat. We've caught bats and everything. And basically, we come back with the fact that, well, we've never found an Indiana bat here. We've never found any of their habitat here. And all this information that we have collected from our research, and basically Fish and Wildlife says to us, well, you're not looking hard enough. It's not the fact that we wow. don't have one. It's because we're not looking hard enough. So that is one of the examples that we have taken to the administration and all, is saying, listen, here's some of what we're dealing with here. And the bottom line is that we have people out there that, as we talk about this, that are really, you know, I hate to say it this way, but are true believers in the fact that it's not necessarily that we need progress and we need to build roads. They think that we want to destroy the environment in the process, and that's not the case. We want to make sure that the environment is taken care of as much as anybody. And we follow all the guidelines that are set forth when we're going in and building these roads. But some of these burdensome regulations that are out there are just absolutely ridiculous. And those are some of the things that we say, if you'll streamline these processes for us and allow us to be able to get through these hoops a lot better, and then in turn, that will save money. We can build more projects, and we can get projects done quicker. You know, we look at it this way. When we go to the federal government, we say, we have taken care of ourselves. The state of Georgia stepped up to the plate. We realized we needed more revenue. We took the hard stance. We raised that revenue. We increased our motor fuel tax, something that is not popular, but something that policy-wise we knew was the right thing to do if we wanted to move forward. So we've used that example when we've went to the Fed saying Georgia has stepped up to the plate. Unlike other states, we have stepped up and we've taken care of ourselves. Same thing could be said on the local level. From local governments in the state of Georgia, these regions that have passed the TIA legislation, in fact, the region that we live in South
right.
Georgia,
yep.
just passed a TIA, a referendum on May 22nd. So we'll now have that local revenue coming in that will help us over a 10-year period to be able to go in and complete some projects there. Well, that also gives the local governments there the opportunity, as well as the other three regions that have passed it, to be able to come to the Department of Transportation in Georgia and say, listen, we've taken that step to make sure that we're trying to help ourselves. Can we partner with you? The Department of Transportation committed to that South Georgia region $112 million over the next 10 years to partner with the region on projects down there as well.
And we thank you for that $112 million.
Oh, yeah. Well, listen, we want to help those that take care of themselves, you know, and that's important. You do have other counties in the state that have passed a T-splice for their
county. Single county, yeah.
A single county T-splice. But, you know, some of the arguments that you hear, and I want to make sure that this is out there, when we wrote the TIA legislation, in fact, I was the author of it as well, we made sure that we put in that legislation that if a region passes it, they cannot be penalized because they passed it. In other words, at GDOT, we can't sit here and say, well, y'all have got all this extra money coming in this region, so now we're not going to give you any more money. We're going to go give it to somebody else. We can't do that. It's in code. It's in law that says you cannot discriminate against a region because they passed it. They stepped up to the plate. They took matters into their own hands. They made that tough vote, so now we want to reward them as well.
Let me ask you this, and I don't want you to name another state by name or anybody, but, you know, you kind of made reference to some of the other states, and I know, because in talking to you, I know you've been asked to go to different conferences and talk about what we're doing in Georgia. I think one time you said you were on a radio show up in somewhere in New England. You said they probably couldn't understand how you were talking.
Yeah, yeah.
But
that was in Boston.
Yeah, they talk a little different out there.
Yeah.
But talk about some of your observations as you've, you know, gotten into this role. Some of the other states that, because they hadn't done this, I mean, some of them are in real trouble.
They are in real trouble. In fact, there's a lot of states that join us that's got issues and that are trying to figure out now, how do they solve their infrastructure needs? They're trying to figure out how, from a legislative standpoint, is there a willingness there to put some other kind of revenue measures in place? And they have stepped up, but not to the degree that Georgia has. They've basically, what I would call, put a put a cork in a big hole that they've got there to stop it, stop the flow a little bit, but they still got problems. You do have states that have long been taking care of themselves. Florida is one of the examples that a lot of states look to as well, that has taken care of themselves for a long period of time, and now Georgia's one of those states. It was interesting in that I went on the radio show there in Boston, and it was interesting because the guy told me, he said, you know, listen, we're a Democratic state, and we can't seem to pass a revenue measure like y'all passed in Georgia in a predominantly Republican state. And so that's kind of the discussions that we had. How did we go about doing it? And I think the biggest thing was we went out to educate the people, to let them know the shape that the state was in. We took that case to them. We held hearings all around the state of Georgia, allowed people to come in from local governments to businesses to industries to the everyday citizen to come in and talk about the issues that they're having. And I think that the citizens at the end of the day understood that we needed more funding for transportation. We needed more infrastructure funding if we were going to continue to move this state forward. And I used to say this, transportation means two different things. If you're in the metropolitan area, transportation is really about getting a person from point A to point B in a reasonable amount of time. You have individuals that are sitting in their cars on a daily basis, an hour, hour and a half, one way in an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours, in the afternoon headed back. That's taking time away that they could spend with their families. If you're in the rural parts of the state where we're from, transportation is all about economic development. It's about being able to have the infrastructure in place so that we can recruit business and industries to come into our areas and say that if you'll come in, if you'll locate here, we've got the workforce and we've got the infrastructure to be able to take care of your needs. And that was something that I think was important as we went throughout the state. And I think, generally speaking, the people understand it. They've been able to see the cones, the barrels, the construction that's going around. We don't apologize for it.
Yeah,
we
there's just a lot of those around the state right now.
We just say, pardon our progress.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of progress. And, yeah, there's some pain with that progress. But at the end of the day, it's going to be good for the state as a whole.
All right. Jay Roberts, thanks so much for joining us on Small Town Podcast and talking about Georgia infrastructure.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
My name is Lance Jones. I'm the city manager for Dublin, Georgia.
And what's the population of Dublin?
About 16,000 people.
And talk briefly about the impact of LMIG, CDBG, any kind of T-grants, the impact that those federal fund programs have on Dublin.
It's tremendous. There's no way we would get our streets paved, infrastructure done without them. Or we'd get it done, but it'd be slow, and they'd be in bad, bad shape by the time we got them done.
Now, you had a particular project that you were talking about earlier, and something where you used federal funds, I believe, from the Commerce Department. So talk to us about that, and again, that economic impact that project, because of federal funds, had on Dublin.
Well, we had an empty industrial park, and we're looking for somebody to come into it. We attracted the attention of a German company, and between the county, our industrial development authority, and the city, we were still about $1,300,000 short on what we needed to do. So we put together an application to the federal government, to the Commerce Department, to get an economic development grant to fill that gap.
Without filling that gap, what was the impact of the company? Because I know you got them, but what's the employment and the economic impact of that?
The company was Airdrick Manufacturing. They came in. They currently have 180 jobs. They're exceeding their employment projections, and they're about to expand. So good jobs, good paying jobs, really helping the community.
And did that project have any follow-on impact as far as other companies that were able to come as a result of what you did in that industrial park?
Oh, absolutely. That $1,300,000 investment from the federal government let us put infrastructure in through the whole park. And so we were ready when another company came along. A Latvian fiberglass mat manufacturer came in, Valmira Glass, and when they came in with where they made the mats, they were so happy there, they came in with a full fiberglass production facility. So in that industrial park now, it's employing over 600, well, right at 600 people.
And so without federal funds, if they cut those programs or if you weren't able to get that particular grant that allowed you to finish that project, what kind of impact would that have going forward?
It might still be an empty industrial park. It might just be sitting there with nobody. It's because of being able to attract these industries, and industries like to see a successful brother industry coming in, you get better at attracting them. With those plants, that's the biggest impact it's had. We've been able to attract a couple more to the area very close by, and our unemployment rate has gone from 14% to 5%. Our per capita income since 2009 is up 20% in Lawrence County.
Linda Bluckinser, mayor from the city of Auburn. population of Auburn is just a little over 7,000, with four huge developments going on. We're probably going to double that in the next 4 years.
So what is the importance to your city so far of LMIG or CDBG or any other kind of funding that comes through for infrastructure?
Yeah, so extremely important. Number one is, I think all of the roads in Georgia, no matter what city you're in, have not been kept up. And so the cost keeps rising and the need keeps rising. And so without LMIG, there is no possible way that our city would be able to afford to do the improvements that are needed. We have a lot of truck traffic that comes through. We have a railroad that goes through our town. So our roads get beat up pretty significantly. And that costs a lot of money to go in and do those repairs. So without LMIG, it'd be almost impossible. And then CDBG, extremely important to us. We've done some water infrastructure. We actually annexed in part of our city that they were on wells. And when we were going through the dry spell that we had a couple of years ago, they ran out of water. And so we annexed them in, understanding that they needed to have some water infrastructure brought to them, and applied for CDBG monies to help us with that. Then, following up with that, we put in hydrants for them because they never had hydrants. So just extremely important. We used our CDBG money in another case for revitalizing one of our old historic buildings, and it is now almost ready to be open for a community center and has brought business upstairs on the top floor, business downstairs, and the ground floor is used for the community, GED classes and ESL classes. So you can see that it's just vitally important. Without those things, we would have never been able to help the people that needed help for that water infrastructure. We would not have been able to repair the roads that we've been able to do, certainly not be able to rehab in a 1902 historic building.
Well, you've heard a lot from several experts on various aspects of infrastructure, from the funding sources all the way to the people who work the individual projects. So now what? What do we do with this knowledge? I asked Brittany Kohler from the National League of Cities what the action items are.
Sure. So I'll start with just saying that what a city should do today is have a plan. That plan really needs to resonate with your local values, your local business purposes, how you can use that new asset, how you can expand based on what you currently have. And so I would say that's always the place to start, because once you have a plan, it's a lot easier to go to Congress and really tell the story about what's possible. And that's really the future of all infrastructure funding, is that cities need to make sure that they are really looking at their needs strategically, that they're connecting into their state plans for the future, and that, frankly, Congress should come in and support those plans if it fits a national purpose. And I think nothing resonates more than broadband in that category. I think transportation is certainly up there as well. And water infrastructure, that those are basics that keep our economy moving. And so I would say that those things are all joint efforts, that this is a true partnership. But what a city can really do to help make sure that they're moving the needle is to make sure that they're thinking about what they need to do on the ground and what's going to help them. Because we don't want to invest in just anything. We want to invest in the best thing for your community at the national level.
So what is it? We've got an audience of people who are in local government, and obviously everybody listening is involved in a local government, at least at the citizen level. So what would you ask them to do, whether it's contact a member of Congress or senator? What do you want to come out of this conversation as far as what can we do as citizens and as local government leaders to make the right things happen for now and in the future?
So right now is a great time to be in touch with your member of Congress. It's also a time when they're going to be home more often than they usually are, that they're stepping away from Washington to really listen to their citizens and to their elected officials on the ground and to hear what's going on and how they can help you. So I would say this summer is particularly critical to get in front of your member of Congress, talk to them about your infrastructure needs, talk to them about where you think you're going as a community and how they can help. I think really focusing on that vision for where you're going is the way to talk to them. That is such a conversation that you are the best advocate for yourself in this case. We at the national level are always going to promote what needs to happen, where we can help the nation and help individual cities in that. But you can be the best advocate for yourself to ensure that that member of Congress is on top of their infrastructure issues and making good choices for your city.
Then I asked Becky Taylor at GMA about the conversation at the congressional level regarding infrastructure funding.
Every year that I've been with GMA, CDBG has been threatened to be either cut significantly or just eliminated. Everything's sort of on the table up there. I know it may seem like things move very slowly at the federal level, but it is very important to stay in constant contact with our federal leaders to tell them how important programs are like that, because there's always something else that they could use that funding for. And if we don't say, you know, look, this is something that helps my community, then they don't know. I mean, to be fair, they are dealing with a million different things, and they're not in your community every day, so they don't see it, and that's why it's important to them. And they tell us every time we sit down and meet with them, we'll ask, you know, what's the best way we can support you? How can we be a resource to you? And the answer always is, they'll ask the city official, just send me your story. Tell me what's going on in your community. I need your stories. We have to continue to get that message through, and also to talk about what we're already doing as residents and as local officials too. I think in this state there's a 96% track record for approval for special purpose local option sales tax over the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. We will tax ourselves to pay for something if we think it'll help with some infrastructure in our community. We want to see these things done. It's not like we haven't put local skin in the game, but we can't do it on our own. Local governments have financed projects through municipal bonds. We have several counties around the state who just passed TSPLOST. We have four regions now that have the TIA. We'll do what it takes, but we can't borrow our way out of this situation. We're going to have the federal government as a partner, and a meaningful partner too. The president's proposal earlier this year for an infrastructure package called for a $1 trillion program that would only include $200 billion in federal funds, meaning an 80-20 split. So 80 would come from local and other sources. And that's not feasible. We're not going to be able to get there with that type of math. So we need to remember when we talk as local leaders, when we talk to our members of Congress, to say we can use funding programs like CDBG block grant programs to get funds through to us. You don't have to create a whole new program. Let's just work on some things that have been successful in the past and build on that. But the federal government must, you know, figure out a way to be a good partner with us and help us get where we need to be, because really the future of our state is what's at risk. And if we don't say anything, it's on us as local officials and as residents too. If we don't say anything, those decisions are going to be made, but whether right. we say anything or not. Right. It's good to have our voice in there. And, you know, the information about the latest issues is, you can find it on GMA's website. We have it in our newspaper that we do, but we also have articles on the GMA website. We have a whole section on federal advocacy on GMA's website, so you can learn more, a little bit more in-depth about what's going on and how federal issues relate to cities. And then you can always call me. You can call Amy Henderson, or you can call me, and we'll be glad to talk with you about how you can get more involved.
Well, small towners, that'll do it for this workshop episode of Small Town Podcast. I hope you learned something from this discussion on infrastructure. Now, most of the time, I just hope you enjoyed the episode and maybe learned something along the way. But this time, I do need you to take some action. If you are a local government official, whether elected or appointed, and you are not regularly engaging with your state and federal representatives and senators, you are doing your community and the people who live in it a great disservice. I encourage you to stay in touch with them about infrastructure needs and other issues as well. Tell them about your successes too. Let them know about the positive impact that a recently funded project is having on members of the district that they represent. If you are not a local official, don't let that stop you. Reach out to your elected officials at the state and the federal level. Let them know the importance of these programs on your community. You don't have to have a title to be a local leader. There's a lot of complacency in today's political climate. If you decide not to let your voice be heard, the elected officials will hear the voice of someone else instead. For more information about issues like this at all levels, you can visit GMA's website at www.gmanet.com and click on the Advocacy tab at the top of the homepage. And Becky Taylor was serious about contacting her if you have questions about how to take action and get more involved on issues like these. Her email address is btaylor@gmanet.com. That's btaylor@gmanet.com. On concerns about infrastructure or other issues that affect our communities across the nation, let's get involved and make our voices heard. I'll talk to you soon, and y'all are welcome to come to Osceola anytime.